Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. We have a really special episode for you today. It features a Zoom interview with Valerie Naranjo. She's maybe the most talented, one of the most talented, successful individuals to ever come out of the great San Luis Valley and here in Alamosa. You may know her from Saturday Night Live. You may know her from The Lion King. You may know her from the work she does in West Africa as a percussionist, just an amazing individual, Valerie Naranjo. And what this is about is she's coming to Alamosa and she's coming to Adams State University to work with students. Students like our own Chris Mondragon, who interviewed Valerie earlier, and that's what you're going to hear. We also had on that interview Melinda Leosi. She's a professor of percussion for Adams State. I was on the interview, asked a couple of questions. That's what we're going to go through. You're going to hear the conversation we had, Chris Mondragon had with Valerie Naranjo. Chris is a student at Adams State. He's a graduate of Alamosa High School, also a musician, an amazing young talent here in the San Luis Valley that we have the great fortune of working with. He works with us here in our studio with Alamosa Citizen and the podcasting we do. Great to have Chris. Chris, let me ask you your interview with Valerie Naranjo and how you felt that went for you and what your just quick takeaway was.
It was great. It allowed me to get a lot of insight into kind of her musical journey and how it took her to, you know, such kind of big places. And it really kind of, as a musician, it was pretty inspiring to kind of hear how perseverance and hard work got her to where she is now. And in preparing to write a story about her upcoming involvement in our concert, kind of just getting a profile on her. And
how would you describe her? Because you're a musician, you're much better at this than me in terms of understanding the talent, the skill it takes. How would you describe Valerie Naranjo as a percussionist, as a musician, as you've learned about her?
She's incredibly talented. She has a great grasp on musicality. She doesn't just kind of play what's written on the paper. She doesn't play the strict right notes and rhythms. She plays it with soul and identity and really makes it something enjoyable to listen to.
One of the instruments she talked about and one she's mastered and become quite famous for is the djil, right? And I hope I pronounced that right. You'll correct me. Are you going to, when she's here in April, she's going to be here in April, you're going to be working with her as well as other Adams State students. Are you anticipating that you're going to learn how to play the djil?
I believe that she's going to do a little masterclass on djil performance for us. So, yeah.
That's very cool. She did say that when you do go to her concert, she's going to be pre-performing two different nights with Chris Mondragon, the rest of the percussionists at Adams State. Those concert events are going to be April 15th, 7 o'clock at Richardson Hall, and then again Thursday, April 16th, 5:30 at Richardson Hall. That's part of the Spring Percussion Festival concert that Valerie is going to be featured in with the Adams State Percussion Ensemble with Chris Mondragon. But she did say, Chris, when you go to those shows with her, you will be standing up and dancing in the crowd. I mean, that's the type of energy that she's going to be bringing when she performs here at Adams State in mid-April.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Here's the interview with Valerie Naranjo and Chris Mondragon we did earlier today.
So what exactly is your connection to the San Luis Valley?
My ancestral roots are in San Acacio. My grandfather had a farm in San Acacio as he moved off of southern Ute land. He then moved with his family to Alamosa. So I grew up from the age of about three in Alamosa. I went to school in Alamosa. I started percussion in middle school. continued in junior high school. And I started attending Adams State as a junior in high school because I wanted to expand my knowledge and my further my interest in percussion studies. And so all of my first band directors, my first private percussion instructor, all are from Alamosa or lived in Alamosa.
You have said that on your first trip to Ghana, it reminded you of your upbringing in the Valley. Did that kind of mental connection help you in your mastery of the geel?
Well, in fact, do you know that a few years ago, around the Sand Dunes National Monument, there were found pieces of slate that were shaped just about like this. And for many years, they couldn't figure out what they were. Were they tools? Were they, what were they? And one ethnomusicologist determined that it was musical instrument, stonophone, so to speak. But when I learned of this instrument in the San Luis Valley, I said, perhaps our feelings and our desires, the things that we search for, go far beyond our conscious mind.
That's very interesting. Okay.
To answer your question, well, it's always great to study something in an environment where the people are, where you have some kind of kinship or some kind of at least friendship with the people around you. And I think this gentleman named Mr. Doncier, who had been to Santa Fe, when he told me that I was going to feel right at home, I thought he was being extremely polite and accommodating to me. But when I started to see the same things that I see in the Valley, the way they shuck corn, way they build adobe houses, at the time when I was growing up, the many dirt roads, those kinds of things, I felt really very much at home.
That's interesting. Very nice. What was the trajectory of your career that kind of led you to playing with Saturday Night Live?
I moved to New York City. I'm going to tell you the short story. The short version of this. I moved to New York City right after undergraduate school at the University of Oklahoma because I wanted to study with a classical marimbist. While the first few years that I was living in New York, I used to play out on the street. I used to play a 4 1/3 octave marimba out on the street. One particular day, I used to play at the Metropolitan Museum. A lot of people go there on Saturdays and Sundays to relax. And to, of course, take in their incredible art collection. I used to play at Columbus Circle, where people were coming home from work, wanted a little bit of relaxation and recreation. But one particular day, I decided to go down to the Lower East Side, where, nobody really has much income at the time. A car pulled up at the curb, and a woman ran straight toward me, and I thought she was going to take my money. But instead, she said, "I am Consuelo. I am from El Taller Latinoamericano, Nueva York. We need a marimba player. Give me your card." And that began my relationship with El Taller Latinoamericano, which was founded by an amazing Argentine composer, lyricist, songwriter, and language teacher named Bernardo Palombo from Mendoza, Argentina. I spent many years at El Taller in their house band. So in the house band, if someone comes from Paraguay and they have $1,000 to pay you in the house band to back their concert, you smile, get the music or not, and you back that person. If someone comes from another place and they have no budget, you smile, and you back that person. So one of the people that I was backing was a musician named Chico da Costa, who was being supported by the great composer Philip Glass. So Philip then came to the concert, and about 2 days later, I got a call from his production company. Could I come in? Would I be interested in helping create an album for Philip, which was the film Poacazzi? I went in, I met a gentleman named Roger Squitura, which was one of the other percussionists who was invited onto the project. And Roger Squitura was a good friend of Lenny Pickett, who is the current band director of Saturday Night Live. Lenny had he had a project, he had his own art band called the Borneo Horns, and he wanted someone who could play four mallet xylophone, which is not a very common thing. They neither of them had my telephone number after the event, after the recording, so I ran into Lenny Pickett in a drum shop to repair one of my drum heads that had broken. I was on an off-Broadway show. And Lenny looked at me and said, "Wow, this is a strange coincidence because we were really trying to find your phone number, and here you are. My band is going to Frankfurt. Would you be interested in playing with us? And I am so, so sorry. We have such a low budget." When he told me the budget, I almost had to pick up my jaw back from the floor because it was so much money. I mean, he called it a low budget. And I said, "Oh, please, I'd be delighted." So I played with Lenny Pickett's Borneo Horns for a couple of years. And then, you know, as musicians do, you go through different phases. And then I didn't hear from Lenny for a number of years. The next time I actually heard from him was in 1995 in August. He left a message on our answering machine saying, "Valerie, we have been considering you for Saturday Night Live band. I remember you from the Borneo Horns. And at the time, the band was going to, the show was on probation because they didn't feel it was going well and didn't have good ratings. So they were going to drop the show. So they gave the show one more year to try to do things to lift it back up. And one of the things that the music department had decided was that they needed to add a percussionist to the band. And I was the one being considered. And what he had actually said was on the answering machine, because he knew my husband, Barry, as well. He said, "Barry, if Valerie happens to be on the road, can you call me back? Because if she's on the road, we're going to have to pass because we have to put this into motion in a day or two." And I would have been on the road, but I wasn't. So that was my beginning in 1995, 30 seasons ago.
Listening to you tell that story, there is so many lessons in that story of someone like you who believes in their own skill to be on the streets of New York playing. Can you give some perspective of the lessons that come out of a story like that, of belief in yourself? Someone discovers you, another door opens, you walk through that door. That's just an interesting to hear you talk about being on the streets of New York. Someone comes up to you and that just cascades into this. It's really interesting to hear that.
Well, my father, we lived at 1885 Ross Avenue, you know, south of town. And he always taught me that if you want to do something, if you have a desire, the last thing you want to do is sit at home and wait for somebody to ask you. You have to go out there and let people, you know, talk to people. Not only, as you say, believe in yourself, but put out what it is that you do. Also, busking, what they call it, you know, playing out on the street, is a source of income. And at the time, I just felt like I'd seen so many of my friends who are musicians, you know, wait tables or do something else. And I said, well, let me really try to stay in music as much as I can. And I had a tremendous time playing out on the street. I met so many amazing people, people who are my friends to this day. But one thing that happened much later on when I was being considered for Saturday Night Live, I had been playing with a very high profile artist named David Byrne. And we were about to go on tour. And David had hired Mitchell Froom was his producer. Mitchell, you could know from a group called Steely Dan. Mitchell was their producer. And Mitchell was delighted that I had all these percussion instruments and that I could sing and play at the same time. And I had keyboard instruments and all kinds of, you know, things that worked for him as a producer. David fired Mitchell. He didn't like the sound. And then David fired me. So at that time, you know, I was in, well, I was much younger than I thought I was. But I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I'm mid-career. This is a disaster. You know, I began to kind of have a spiritual meltdown, but I'm a practicing Buddhist, and many of my friends came to my aid and said, no, this is the time when you really, you're not tested when things are going great. You're tested when things are not going well. And they assured me, this is your test. This is your this is your opportunity to take poison and make medicine. So I was really in prayer that whole summer of 1995, just within myself, trying to understand that, you know, the industry is not, you're not tall enough, you're not short enough, you're not brown enough, you're not white enough. You know, everybody has an excuse to say you're not the right person. But when I finally, in my own heart, said, I am who I am, and there's no one else like me, and there's a place for me, that's when everything opened for my life.
Amazing.
You know, none of us are the same as one another. We all are so distinct. We're all amazing human beings. And that's something I learned in West Africa, that, you know, it's not about how well you play or what you accomplish. It's really owning the ownership of your own humanity and what that brings to the table. That's what's important. Obviously, of course, if you're a musician, you practice. If you're a business person, you do what you have to do. But belief in one's contribution to the world is really the foundation for success.
One of the things you're quoted as saying, Valerie, is we're not in this to compete with one another. We're in this to help one another. And I wonder, how does that play out, like when you're here mentoring students at Adams State, or what will we see when you're here at Adams State, or how does that play out for you in your teaching, your mentoring of students? We're not in this to compete with one another. We're in this to help one another.
Growing up in Alamosa, do you know that there were many, many drummers in my first middle school band? And most of us were women, actually, or young women. I think the camaraderie that I felt from my fellow drummers, when I went to Ghana, I could see that people did not judge a person by, again, what they accomplish, how fast, how furious, how glamorous. They don't judge people, or even how accomplished a musician is. They judge an artist by, can they touch my heart? And that was a big lesson for me to learn. I learned another amazing lesson when I met my husband, Barry Olson, because he's an extremely accomplished trombonist, pianist, and percussionist. But he always seems to have time for everyone, and he's never late. I haven't figured it out. But what I hope to bring to the table when I come to visit you is to be able to have the privilege to share the tremendous gifts that I have been given without expectation from my teachers in America, in West Africa, and in other places in the world that I've been fortunate to visit. This is what projects our society forward, not competition. The makeup of a musical organization is the quintessence of what it means to cooperate with each other. You know, I play with a bass player, an organist, a piano player, a trumpet player, trombonist, and three saxophonists. I cannot play saxophone like that person. They do not play percussion like I do, but we complement each other with what we do. And I think that can be taken to the spiritual level. You know, the real meaning of the word fame means that one has found their reason for being on the earth, and one is fortunate enough to be able to practice that reason and to be able to share it with the world. That is the real meaning of fame. It's been really distorted in Western society. I want to, it's my determination to share some unusual things perhaps, but some of the things that I've learned on my journey, so that I can leave that for those who are going to be doing this long after these hands are not going to work that well.
It's awesome to get to hear you speak, and you know, looking over the podcasts and the articles has been really fun. One of the things that I noticed that you talked about, and I believe that this was something that you got from the Jeel master that you studied with, Kakraba Lobi. Is that how you say that?
Kakraba Lobi.
Yes. Okay, Kakraba Lobi. So I believe that he told you that he doesn't start with the easy things. He starts with the important things. And that's, you know, of course, referencing rhythms or, you know, learning the Jeel. And you were wondering, why is he starting with something that, you know, technically was much more difficult? And that kind of got me thinking, just as a professor, you know, what are some of the things that you've taken from studying with people in West Africa, with, you know, Kakraba Lobi, and what have you taken back to your teaching at NYU and sort of adapted from that style of teaching in, of course, in combination with the teaching that you've kind of learned from where you grew up in Alamosa and where you ended up in New York? How has that kind of gone over to your teaching at NYU?
One of the things that I found in my 27 journeys to West Africa is that there's a belief in especially traditional rural West African society that everybody has the gift of art. Everybody can cook, because culinary art is a big, big deal in West Africa. Everybody can dance. There's a saying, if you can talk, you can sing. If you can walk, you can dance. I don't want to distort the truth, and, you know, because there are masters, of course, and they are looked up to and they are respected. But art is for everyone. Music is for everyone. The teaching style is by osmosis. So that was very, that was my first big challenge, to study with someone who didn't allow me to say, oh, what's the first thing you do? And what's the second thing you do? But he immersed me. His name was Noam Baru. He immersed me in the music and then taught me a new way of listening, actually. Taught me not to expect to be spoon-fed, yet to be able to use my ears and my senses to take in the music. One thing that Noam Baru taught me above any all else, one of the days that we were sitting together, this was back in like 1988, and he had taught me something the night before, and we were going over it the next morning, and I couldn't remember most of what he had taught me. And I put my malice down and I said, ah, Baru, I'm bad. He was a very strict guy. He didn't speak much English either. He said, what? I said, I'm bad. I can't remember. He said, you are not bad. You're a human being. Human beings are great. And this light bulb went off in my head. I'm like, oh my gosh, because, you know, we're, as young people, as students, as members of society, sometimes we tend to judge ourselves according to what we can do at a certain period of time. And just him saying that just unlocked something so profound for my life, that I am okay exactly as I am, and I can just move forward with that in the best way that I know how. One of the things that I took from West Africa, you know, straight to the table, when I first came back from Ghana, I was teaching in a public school, elementary school on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, was that if you get off of a piece of paper and go directly to the music, you will probably be surprised at how quickly people can pick it up. I had the opportunity to teach in Pennsylvania for a year. I was an artist in residence to a group of young people who were not musicians. None of them had ever played a musical instrument. And I tried to apply what I learned from Baru, from Kakraba Lobi, from people like Bernard Woma, people like a wonderful drummer named Kofi Nisiso, another wonderful drummer named Godwin Agbeli, that if you're a patient, if you believe that every person in your circle or your class or your group has the ability to do this, that is really half of the cycle. Mm. Teacher must really create the situation for the student to be able to listen and observe. I observed this in another place. My husband and I spent most of the year of 1994 in South Africa, and we were privileged. You know, at the time, that country just opened up. There was a cultural ban of exchange because of the political situation in South Africa. But when Nelson Mandela was elected to the presidency, that all opened up. And we were fortunate enough to be there at the first festival of the inauguration. And one of the people who came to that festival was named Adama Drame. He was from the Ivory Coast. And sure enough, we would go out into Soweto and all these different places outside of Johannesburg. And he carried with him the belief that everybody in the room, whether they'd ever played a drum or not, he's a djembe master, they'd be able to play. And there was a certain young woman who just, you know, she didn't seem to have a sense of rhythm. And in my mind, I was ready to write her off. Mm. You know, I discussed it with Adam, and he said, nope, she's, the advantage that this young woman had is that she believed in herself. You know, she didn't just, you know, most of us will say if you're not keeping up with the group, you're kind of back off and shy away. She believed in herself. Do you know, she became one of the best people in his place called Yeovil, a group of djembe players. So that's the biggest thing I think I've taken away from West Africa, is that every human being is great. We are great regardless of how we play, and we can be patient with each other if we just create the amount of time that it takes.
I have one more question, and it's about your, you know, role as both a percussionist and a vocalist. So I think it's really great. I know that we're doing a vocal piece together, and I also my secondary instrument is vocals. So I think it's really fantastic that that you also, you know, perform percussion and find ways to incorporate vocals. So I wanted to know maybe some of the other experiences that you've had kind of combining those two instruments, percussion and vocals.
I first started singing when I was 5 years old. Well, this song is part of our family. Singing is just a given. I think I was in second grade when I realized, because I went over, I did a sleepover with a, you know, classmate, and I asked, so when are we going to sing? And they thought I was crazy. But my extended family, whenever we ever got together, we'd always sing. We'd always do some kind of singing. Now in West Africa, one sings, dances, and plays an instrument. Sometimes all at the same time. But certainly, everyone who calls himself an artist because in some languages there's not a specific word for music. It's all art. Anyone who calls themselves an artist or everyone who practices art knows that their voice, their body movement, and an instrument, that those three things are always involved. When I first began to sing and play the traditional geo music in Ghana, you see, I wasn't uncomfortable singing because I studied art song at the University of Oklahoma. I've always loved to sing, and I always have sung. But when I tried, both the singing and the playing were very complex. So when I first tried to combine them, my teachers wouldn't chuckle; they would actually laugh. But I said, it's just going to take a while, and I'm just going to be able to do this at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I have always written for voice. A lot of my compositions are a cappella voice. It's always been a part of my life. It's been a tremendous advantage to be in a rock band or to be in an R&B band or jazz band and be able to do backing vocals while playing an instrument. So I really would have to say, though, that my training in West Africa was what allowed me to unleash that ability that we all have to funnel playing and singing into the same song.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be doing some of that. We'll be dancing. Again, when I first started dancing in West Africa, nobody would chuckle. They laughed out loud. I kind of shut down for a minute. I said, maybe I'm not really supposed to be a dancer. When I joined the faculty at NYU, they said, you need to teach dance. NYU is a very progressive university. They try things that are unusual. And one of the things that the department has said is we have to dance. And so when you go back to Ghana this summer, go study dance. And that really opened up my music. It opened up my singing. Some of these concepts that are very well known on the African continent make us in the West into better artists. Mm-hmm. And that is a treasure that I cannot keep to myself. I've been so fortunate, and I will be very, very fortunate to be able to share it with all of you.
So how did you and Professor Liosi first become acquainted?
I think we actually met at a Percussive Arts Society International Convention. The Percussive Arts Society was formed over 50 years ago so that people who play drums and xylophones and marimbas could kind of get together. I think the first national meeting was somewhere in upstate New York, like Rochester, somewhere like that. And it's been growing ever since that time. There's an international convention every year, and I always try to go. I've performed in it about 20 times, but I always try to go because I know that I'll meet someone amazing. And I believe we met at that convention. Is that true?
I think so. When I got to Adams State, and I think it's okay to share that, you're a huge supporter of the department at Adams State and a huge supporter of this community. And that also is, some financial support that we do get as an endowment with you and another person, right?
Yes, David Clemmer, who was a music student at Adams State.
Yes. And, when I got here, and I was learning the ropes, and it was fall of 2020 when I started at Adams, they shared with me, Valerie Naranjo has a connection to this area and is from here. And I found out about that endowment, and we were able to take that, and we have used the money to fund trips to PASIC with students from Adams. We have used that to maintain and repair instruments, steel pans, gotten our steel pans tuned. So that's a huge help for us in the percussion department. And then I found out that you have come many times before COVID and, you know, worked with the students. So it was always in the back of my mind, it would be awesome to have, you know, Valerie out to this festival and come back to Alamosa and work with the students again. And, you know, another thing, and this kind of reminds me of what you said, you know, that many of the percussionists that you had in, even in your middle school band were female. You know, as a female percussionist, I like to bring in, you know, a great diversity of guest artists. You know, I'm a female percussionist. I love to lift up other female percussionists, percussionists of color, percussionists of all different, you know, variety of backgrounds and what their, you know, expertise, you know, is in. And so it's been so much fun for me over the years. I've been full-time teaching for about 10 years now, just to bring in, you know, so many different guests just to enhance my own students' understanding of things that I might not, you know, be able to do, but I can bring someone else in to, you know, open up that world for students. So that's kind of, you know, when I thought of that, you know, let's see if she'll come out and do the festival. And I was so happy when you were so gracious to, you know, we talked at PASIC and you said, yeah, of course I'll do it. I was very excited.
Thank you. It's a privilege. And for several years, I and Barry came out once a year. It's going to be like, a homecoming for me to come out again. And interesting that this is the year that my high school, my high school class is going to be celebrating their 50th class reunion.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, are you going to come?
It's really a homecoming. I can't believe I'm that old.
Are you going to come to your reunion? Are you having a reunion that you're going to come to?
I hope so. I haven't heard yet, but I think it's 50th year. So it's a great way to celebrate. And, thank you for having me. It's always a privilege. It's always a privilege to meet young people. I think that's the older that I do get, the more I realize that it's my responsibility and my pleasure to be able to share the wonderful experiences I've had in one way or another. That's what humanity is about. That is real peace and culture and education, I feel.
Do you ever pause and look back and see how far you've come since you're growing up here? And it's such an amazing career, and there's so much depth to your career and your accomplishments. And I just wonder if you ever look back and how do you sum it up so far?
I look back every day, but it's interesting that you ask this. This particular weekend was a pretty loaded weekend. There is a woman named Veronica Savat, who is from Spain, who has, through the United Nations in New York, the United Nations Center in New York, created an organization called Global Voices for Peace. So as I was pulling the computer out to set up, this is what came out. This is the concert that we did on Friday at a place. And it was all women composers with the United Nations Orchestra. It was a big event. I think it was extremely successful. And it was Veronica who mentioned to all of us, she's done a lot of research about women in the arts. She said only 5% of the programming of classical pieces and contemporary pieces for orchestra is composed by women. So it was her vision to change that. Now, of course, we all volunteered our time, but you know, I said, yeah, right on. If we don't do something, it's not going to get done. We can't just, as my father would say, you can't just sit around or wait for it to get done. You have to go out there. Then the next morning was Saturday Night Live. So it was like 16 hours of Harry Styles, and everybody was, you know, it was very lively show because, you know, there's a lot of Harry Styles fans out there. And then on Sunday, I went to a recording studio, and we did our best attempts to finish up a video. And while I was texting my friend Randy Crafton, who owns this studio in Union City, New Jersey, I've forgotten a couple of the details, and I said, you know, it's really great when your life is so filled with amazing experiences that you can't keep them all straight. So yes, I think every day I have the opportunity to thank the gods and to thank the universe for being on this planet. You know, it's a very interesting time to be on this planet. It's a time, in my opinion, not to just stand by and watch crazy things happen, but to get on in there and you know, level the balance of stable and unstable. You know, life is always a balance of different forces. And if we believe what we're doing is for the good of society or humanity, then, you know, it's better to be out there doing it, I think.
You also, Valerie, seem to be your truism to the saying that talent is not bound by zip code, that your zip code does not define you. You define your zip code, that talent is found everywhere. And you come out of South Alamosa and you're amazing with your career. And I wonder if you can reflect on just that notion that it doesn't matter where you grow up, that if you have it, you have it, and you can succeed. And you're a great example of that.
Thank you very much for saying that. When I went to West Africa, I always kind of felt sometimes, I didn't always feel, but at times I felt in Alamosa that there were some folks, my neighbors, who were extremely accomplished, extremely talented. And I felt a little twinge, like they're not getting perhaps the respect or recognition that I think that they should have. Well, when I went to West Africa, you could times that by 1,000, by 10,000. All of these amazing, I mean, people doing things that you and I would never imagine, who will never sit in front of a television camera, who will never be interviewed by a newspaper. And they don't do it for that reason. They do it because they know that the community needs dance or music or composition. The community needs art, and they are the ones who are going to bring it to the community. So, you know, I once heard a Buddhist saying that the reason, the intention behind what a person does is more important than even the activity. So I think for me and for my life, it's important to daily reflect on my intentions. Yeah, of course, when somebody claps for me, you know, when the crowd claps, I'm happy, you know, like, oh, yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm cool. But we have to all be cool together. We have to reach the state of cool together. That's a happy life. You know, the life of somebody, I'm rich, I'm famous, and there's those people over there. That's not life. Life is when we're all elevating each other and experiencing the joys of life. And boy, drumming is sure one of those.
I know you love teaching. Do you have any words you'd like to share with those in what could be described as the trenches, the K-12, that aren't necessarily, I mean, they're starting these kids when they haven't ever played and don't always get the respect or recognition, as well as how did those early teachers here in the valley, like, keep you going? Like, what if there hadn't been a music program here?
If there hadn't been a music program in Alamosa, I don't know where I'd be. What you're speaking of, Linda, is it reminds me of some concerts that I've played in my life when there's like 10 people in the audience and you think, whoa, you could think, and I did think, this is not a successful event. But if there's one person, And I've really been taught this through my Buddhist practice. If there's one person who's discouraged and you can encourage one person, that is great. That is profound. Because it takes one person. It took one Nelson Mandela to change the fate of South Africa. It took one Abraham Lincoln to change the entire fate of this country. And you never know when you're going to be teaching Nelson Mandela or Abraham Lincoln or any number of amazing. So I have taught classes that I thought, you know, I don't know if I'm making any difference. We just have to trust ourselves that every day is a journey. And, you know, every day is not, you know, I could drive from Phoenicia to my house and it's sunny and beautiful. And that's a particular kind of journey. Or I could drive to Phoenicia and it's snowing and blowing and, you know, the wipers are not wiping the snow off of the front of my car. That's another, I'm going to feel a different way, but I'm still taking the journey.
You're talking about so many profound things, and I want to pivot back to like a real percussionist to percussionist kind of question. Sure. And you know, just because I'm curious, so I really loved one of the stories that you told in some of the press that I, you know, listened to, when you said there was someone who wanted you to play Shakaday, and you really had not played, and you spent like about the next 6 weeks learning to play Shakaday to make sure that you could show up for the gig and, you know, do what they needed you to do. And, you know, it ended up going well, and you put so much work into that. So, you know, this kind of leads me to just a question about setup. You know, on Saturday Night Live, do you use a standard setup? Does it, you know, what instruments are included generally that you have? And of course, there's the ones that I can see, you know, when I'm looking up there. But I was wondering what your sort of typical setup was. And also, if that changes based on, you know, the guest or from week to week. You know, I know the guests bring in their own bands, but are there times where you might actually play with the musical guest and, you know, certain sketches or certain things? So just some nuts and bolts percussion questions.
Sure. Starting with the story that I told it somewhere about the Shakaray, that was for Saturday Night Live. They were very, you know, they were excited. Ah, percussion, you know, we got to really push. Oh, by the way, when I joined Saturday Night Live, I joined on probation because they didn't know whether they would be able to keep me. So I had three shows to play. I played three shows, and after the third show, there's a two-week break, typically every year. And they discussed, you know, is this worth the expense, adding another person? So, of course, those in the music department, you know, were trying to make sure that I stayed and, you know, that I would be a permanent member. So Cheryl Hardwick, who was one of the music directors at the time, called me on the phone and said, you know, we know you play marimba and vibes, but that's a really big logistical thing. I think that's not a good thing. We know you play congas, but we're not going to have people haul the congas to the front of the stage. Again, that's bad logistics. Do you play Shakaray? And I didn't. And I had like 1 second to say, do I say no? But because I knew a lot of great Shakaray players, I said, yeah, I can play. And the next phone call was to a great Shakaray master. And that, like, as you said, it was several weeks of just mastering this amazing instrument. So I have now 5 Shakarays in my setup. I have a glockenspiel and a xylophone. I have a table. It's kind of like the LP table, except it gets expanded kind of. It's much bigger. Of handheld percussion. So I have, you know, very standard percussion instruments. Like I have a series of cymbals that I play, a chime tree. I have the across the board chime tree and the up and down chime tree, and about another 125 instruments that I don't play the all of those all every show. But the standard setup is one timbali, because there's not enough room for the pair. 3 conga, a Panlogo drum from West Africa, a djembe, and a pair of bongos. Then the other number of instruments, it really depends. It really depends more on my role in the band. Lenny Pickett calls the percussion chair the wild card of the band. In other words, the reason they added a percussionist is because no matter how great, in his opinion, a band is, if you're listening to 10 songs and it's not a band concert, you know, it's just the band between musical sketches, he was of the opinion that it could sound the same. You know, attention span is short and it could end up sounding similar to the song before it. So my role in that band is to be playing a different instrument every song. So I've been really fortunate to collect instruments from all over the world. I found on tour, for example, in Portugal, in Lisbon, I went to the garage sale of a church. In other words, they were cleaning out their archives and they were selling things in front of the church, these amazing bells. And I put them on the table and use them as like almost like a mallet percussion instrument, things like that. And of course, things from West Africa, from Brazil, all over the place. That is part of my role, to make the band look and sound different every song. Awesome. Have I answered your question?
Yes, yes, for sure. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, percussionists, we as percussionists have an incredible role, because if you're a violinist, you're a member of the string section. If you're a violinist, you don't play bass, you don't play viola, although occasionally. You don't play cello, you play the one instrument. We as percussionists, we play timpani, we play mallets, we play all different kinds of instruments. And that's one of our challenges, is to be able to keep on top of all these different kinds of instruments.
With the GL being so deeply steeped in kind of spiritualistic practices, do you think that performing this style of music with these kinds of instruments create a unique kind of connection between the artist and the audience that maybe isn't present in other kinds of music?
It's presumptuous for me to say, but I'll say it anyway. I enjoy playing the geel because I know of, there's just so much spiritual depth, as you spoke of. Whenever anyone sits behind a geel, tradition says that there are three energies that come into play. And that's the energy of the composer who wrote the song, the energy of the person themselves, the player, and the energy of the materials and the people people and animals and plants who created the materials and brought the materials together to make the instrument. I feel from my audiences that there is a certain connection that they feel that is very spiritual. When you hear the instrument, it's got a buzz that sound technicians call an extremely complicated sound. It's sounding on many levels. Well, tradition has it that one of those levels comes from a spider's egg case that is placed over the resonator. It makes it kind of making that buzz. And that buzz is for the ancestors. So that when you're playing music, there's people in the room or in the park or in the field or wherever it might be that are listening to your music, but it's also resonating in their heart. And the ancestors are also able to listen to your music. They really believe that. And, you know, we talk in the West about ancestor worship and this and that. I don't see it that way. I see that there is a keen awareness among the West Africans that I have studied with and have been privileged to be around and to be in comradeship with, that everything comes from somewhere. Everything around you yourself come from parents, but we all have the chair, the people who made the chairs, the people who grew the food. Everything comes from somewhere. And if we can be connected and appreciative of those sources, we'll probably be a little bit better informed and a little bit deeper thinking and a lot happier. And so I think that all comes through. You know, the thing about music is that it creates a sound vibration. It tells its own story. The energy coming out of it, people, they feel it. And, you know, whether it's a geel or a djembe or a harmonica from Mississippi or an accordion from Norway, all of these instruments have their energies. And I think that people feel that and that they appreciate it if they're listening well. You know, and, you know, one small note about that, you know, with the advent of the internet and the fact that I can take my cell phone and I can hear an entire movie on my cell phone, you know, it's done interesting things to our sense of art. You know, I for example, I love hearing, you know, the Berlin Symphony on a compact disc, but hearing the Berlin Symphony in a symphonic hall is a completely different experience because I'm hearing the sound vibration.
Absolutely.
Sound vibration. And one thing, if anything I can pass on, is that live music is a very special experience. And you know, you shouldn't be satisfied substituting canned music for live music. Though I know a lot of young people who, you know, have gone to like one or two concerts in their life. And that's unfortunate because that vibrations heal and they rejuvenate and they get us ready for work the next day.
You'll get to meet and work with Chris, but I will say he's a bit rare in this day and age. Like, Chris is a true music lover and plays music with his family, with his brother. And, you know, that's one thing that I've really noticed. I mean, has a sort of uncommon knowledge of musicians and bands and music history and, you know, and pop music and everything that I don't see a lot. And Chris, that's something I appreciate about you, by the way.
Thank you.
My husband is a jazz musician who played for many years on the Latin scene in New York. And just understanding the struggles that so many people have gone through to fulfill their musical careers is, you know, it's part of our legacy and it's really part of our treasure to be aware of, you know. And
yeah, totally.
I appreciate that you take the time to be aware.
I have one last question for you. And then we could move on to, you know, some of the other people. As you observed geel playing in West Africa, you noticed the presence of, like, polymeter improvisation and, you know, things of that sort. And we have, you know, names for those things in Western music theory. But that environment is kind of absent from conventional Western music theory. But yet those ideas were still present. Do you find these concepts to be somehow inherent to nature?
Oh, absolutely. Well, number one, though, whether it's Waylon Jennings or Dolly Parton or Harry Styles or Monk or any musician in America, that music comes from West Africa. It's based on West African music. The idea that you play a certain chord and you sing over it and then you change the chord and you sing, that's a West African concept.
Yeah.
But any West African musician will tell you, we got our music from the insects. You know, when someone first told me that, I kind of chuckled. I'm like, oh, cool. But the next time I was out by a lake in the nighttime, listening carefully, I said, you know what? He's absolutely right. There is a certain kind of symphony that happens between natural forces. So I think it is in nature, absolutely. And it was, those who have gone before us, probably for millennia, who observed nature and brought it to a couple of planks And then somebody said, well, let's put four planks together. Let's put eight. Let's put 14. And that's really how musical instruments were born, according to many traditions. I'm still waiting, you know, patiently. I know I haven't done a lot of research, but to see that musical instrument that is probably somewhere in one of the museums by the Sand Dunes National Monument, because we have our own version of the geo in this valley. It's exciting.
It is.
Really enjoyed the conversation, Valerie, and appreciate all your time that you've given us. I wonder what a typical week is like for you, given all the things you balance and responsibilities you have. I wonder what a typical week is like, and if you have any best practices on how you keep so many balls in the air.
For many years, Chris, I played in The Lion King on Broadway. I have recently retired from that, and that has taken me back to a kind of existence that I had when I was 22 years old. You know, a little bit more time for writing and for doing things like that. But I'll walk you through a typical week for 26 years. I'll start at the finish. My last Lion King show ended at 9:30 p.m. on Sunday. I would go home, pack some things, some food and stuff, go to sleep for an hour and a half, get back up, pick up my husband at a place called Smoke, which is a jazz club. He finished his Sunday night regular gig at about 1:30 in the morning. He'd get in the car, and we would go upstate to where I am now. We would stop and grocery shop at about 3:30 in the morning at a fruit stand that was open 24 hours. So we get home around 5. Go to sleep, sleep in, get up around 1. And then on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you know, I'm still doing a lot of research. I hope to do it until I'm 100 years old, if I live that long, about music. Because when you write, I feel that you need to know what's gone before you. So, and also you need to practice your instruments. So those 3 days are for intense practice. And then Thursday around 1 o'clock p.m., go back to the city. If I needed to check in with SNL, you know, if that particular week they needed me, I would check in around 4 o'clock. And do whatever recording was necessary. Then go to the Lion King on Thursday night, get up Friday, teach at NYU from about 11 till exactly 7. And I would tell students, if you have a question, you need to walk with me to the subway because I have to be at the show. I would do the show at 8, do Saturday Night Live, which typically starts around 10:15 a.m. and finishes around 1:45 a.m. the next day. So we're there the whole time. And then Sunday, I would get up. We oftentimes would host a Buddhist meeting, you know, once every 3 weeks or so. But if not, I go straight to the gym and do some workout just to keep my energy up and keep my general health. Do the 1 o'clock Lion King show, have some dinner, and do the 6:30 Lion King show, and then do it all over again. Now, we don't do Saturday Night Live every week, and so the weeks that I'm not doing Saturday Night Live are the weeks that I schedule things like this residency that's going to happen in Alamosa. And I've been fortunate enough to go all over this country. I do that during the Saturday Night Live season, but usually in the summers, then I go abroad because it's very difficult to go abroad and to try to do all this, what I described to you, and, you know, and travel across the Atlantic Ocean. However, I remember in 2017, one particular time I was at the Lion King. I jumped on a plane. I went to Reykjavik, stayed overnight, went to Belgium, helped someone defend their doctoral dissertation, flew back to a Lion King show. And I sat, you know, I did the first song, and then I said to myself, you can't live like this. You have to slow down a little bit. But I've been very privileged to be able to. I think busy is happy, and happy is busy.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that.
My pleasure.
And that's our interview with Valerie Naranjo here on the Valley Pod and with Chris Mondragon. Remember, she will be performing Wednesday, April 15th at Richardson Hall. Then again, Thursday, April 16th, Richardson Hall as part of the Spring Percussion Festival concert featuring Valerie Naranjo and our own Chris Mondragon and the Adams State Percussion Ensemble, Steel Band, and all their friends. This Valley Pod is produced by Owen Woods. See you around the Valley.